Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You're listening to The Sound of London. This is Londonist Out Loud. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe. And this week I'm asking, what does it take to keep a public house, both in the sense of preserving those boozers that have some architectural or design merit, so that future generations can enjoy them? And on a more fundamental level in these tough economic times, keeping the front door open and the booze flowing. Where better to find answers than in Stoke Newington at the Rose and Crown?
Hey baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sound. You ain't never seen the light before, just a stone's throw from your front door. Hey baby, spit out me, see a piece of air, land and sea. Some creep, some saw down the road, jam rack store.
My heart aches for some far off place. No one
Well, hello, hello. It's early in the day, but I am in the corner of a pub, getting comfortable. And it is a comfortable pub. There's a lot of wood panelling here and creaky chairs that you're going to be hearing plenty of. And it's been a late night for me, so I think I might just stay here for the rest of the day. I don't know if my guests are going to be able to do that, though. They are Emily G from Historic England and Martin Harley. And Martin, you're the landlord here. Thanks for having us.
Oui.
Late night for you as well with the rugby. Yes,
indeed it was. We're right. We're feeling, we'll battle through. We'll do our best.
Of course, by the time this goes out, the winners of the rugby will be known.
Oh, is that right?
Yes. How's it shaping up from your side?
Well, I think I'm going to back England-Wales final, actually, even though controversial as it may seem. That's what I still figure now is the time to get your bets on. So if you're hearing this in after 31st of October, then I can make a complete arse of myself, or I could be very clever. So England-Wales final for me.
We could edit this to save your dignity, but with the Rose and Crown in Stoke Newington, and it's before opening time. Why are we here?
We're here because this is one of about 20 pubs from the interwar period, which was listed by Historic England, on advice of Historic England, by the government a few weeks ago. And it's one of a series of what we call reformed or improved pubs from the interwar period, which was a new wave of pub building. And this is a really lovely and special example. So it's been listed at Grade 2. It's on the National Heritage List for England. And it's a really remarkable building as part of an important social movement in that period.
And we'll talk about why in great detail, no doubt. When you say the advice of Historic England, where was the impetus for marking these buildings out as special? Where was that coming from?
Well, Historic England decided to do a project on the interwar pub around the country, a research project. So colleagues in our research group did a lot of work looking at the survival of interwar pubs, their architectural development, the social reason for them, why they were a special building type. And it's partly because they're under threat. It's a building type that we haven't known a huge amount about nationally, and pubs are closing. Pubs are being demolished, pubs are changing use, and it's really important that Historic England is sort of at the leading edge of research into this building type. So colleagues did lots of work to work out how many there were, why they were built, who designed them, which breweries built them. And then from that work, with a really strong kind of national context, we're able to identify the strongest candidates for listing. So of the about 3,000 that were built in the 1920s and 30s, we could work out those which survived the best, which were the most architecturally important, and then identify which should be listed. And that's where our team comes in. We're part of the listing group. And so we looked at all of the pubs that were identified as the strongest candidates and recommended about 20 for listing around the country, but about half of those are in London. And they add to, so about, I think we listed about 9 pubs in London from the 1920s and 30s, of which this is one. And that about doubles the number of pubs built between the war, which are on the National Heritage List in the capital.
maybe a good moment to describe the place. And I'm conscious, Martin, that you must see this with a very particular eye.
I mean, that's tricky. I think it's an oldie, worldie, oakie affair, really. Obviously, lots of wood panelling. I always say it's a great winter pub, really, because of the log fires, because of the fireplaces, because of the oak panelling. You know, there's no finer place to be late at night when drinking some mulled wine, sitting next to the fire, the candles on, you know, and obviously you've got a great view of Church Street because of the open window there. Mm-hmm. So, I think it's a really kind of a winter-feeling pub. There's no outside space as such. It's a warm pub. It's got a great feeling. You walk in, maybe not 10 o'clock in the morning, but certainly late at night when the winter's evening, when it's dark and cold out and you come into a roaring log fire, the lights are dimmed. We don't play loud music, so it's all about the ambience, it's all about the atmosphere, it's all about the people that drink in the pub and the bar staff and actually the atmosphere, really. And because it conveys that warmth, because of the wood and obviously the beautiful ceiling and the log fires, you know, it's got a real kind of village feel to the pub, actually, rather than, you know, although we're in Stoke Newington, it's still a village, as it were.
And it does have that villagey feel as soon as you turn the corner onto Church Street. I know we'll be talking more about the ceiling because there's something special going on there, but when somebody describes to me a pub as being wood-panelled, I think of something a lot gloomier than this and a lot more closed in than this. And I noticed that there are the beams going across, a double set of beams traversing the room, and built into those glass panels, so the light's coming through, the light's reflecting off this ceiling as well. So at the same time as having those qualities that make it a good winter pub, it feels kind of breezy and comfortable in the summertime as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure, Emily, we could probably tell you more about this, but I still think, considering it was built in about 1930, this beautiful arch window that we can see, we've got great views of Church Street. I mean, most, you know, obviously we've got these views of pubs with, you can't see in, and, you know, sort of fellas, old boys drinking in there, and you can't see what's going on inside. Here, this is obviously 1930, it must have been very unique for its time, where you can actually got great views and you can see in and out of the pub. So it is, you're right, it's very airy and very light and bright, but actually you could hide away in the public bar as we're sitting currently, or you could sit with a great view of what's going on and see the world outside. So, yeah, it covers all bases, really.
I was going to ask you how long you've been here, but that's the easy part of the question. The more complex question, I guess, is what it looks like to be a landlord of a pub in the current environment. We hear about pubs going out of business left, right and centre. What's been your path to be here, and how secure are things generally?
I could bore you forever on that one. So my parents bought this pub 30 years ago. So we moved to Stoke Newington in 1985 when I was a wee lad, and I ran it for a few years myself. Back in the day, then I went off and done my own thing. I've now got a small pub company called London Village Inns. We've got a few pubs around London, a couple of craft beer pubs, but for here, I've seen many, many changes over the last 30 years. And it is quite a tricky environment, the pub business. It's not easy. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it to anybody. However, you know, it's a good business if you get it right. I've seen many changes over the years. It's a good business to be in. I'm a big fan. I love the game, but I think you've got to enjoy the business. You've got to enjoy what you do. I've seen, for this pub particularly, I remember in 1985 when we took over, I mean, for example, Sunday lunchtimes, 12 till 2, 7 till 10:30. That's when the opening hours were. It was a different period. So people would be knocking on the door at 12 o'clock to get in for their 2 hours drinking, and then everyone leave at 2 o'clock. Now, it's a different environment. The pubs have changed. People do food more than ever before, so you've got to embrace that. But the all-day opening on Sunday created the Sunday roast, really, because all of a sudden people have come to the pub for Sunday roast. Prior to that, people were actually going home and either having to sleep at 2 o'clock in the afternoon or going home for their roast dinner.
And presumably that gets to be a more cost-effective thing if it's going on all day.
I probably wouldn't be in the pub game if it wasn't for the Sunday roast, really. We were in the Wrestlers in Highgate 18 years ago, and it was all about the Sunday roast, really. I used to do the odd lock-in, to be fair, but it was all about the Sunday roast, and we used to pack them in on a Sunday. That was obviously when the smoking ban was still in, so times were different then. So it wasn't, you know, it was more of a Sunday roast was a big time for food. Now, obviously, you're going to pubs and it's all about food. It's a lot, not all about food, but it's a lot about food. There's a lot of gastro pubs. So times have, but the pub has evolved. I've seen a lot of change in the last 30 years. Unless you keep up, you will kind of die. So the pubs that do struggle probably haven't kept up maybe as well as they probably should have done. And that's embracing the changes, what with the smoking ban that came in. So then you've got to think about what do we do now. So it has gone more foodie. So you have to embrace that. But I think, I mean, here's a tricky one, because this we're tight. This is a Heineken owned pub, so we have a lease, we have a 20 year lease, so we have to buy a beer through Heineken. So we're kind of tied a wee bit on what beer we can stock. You know, it's a bit tricky, especially in your sort of this where, you know, we've got lots of little small craft shops and cafes and pubs, and so it is difficult. So we have to kind of make sure this is as good as we can be. So that's why we keep the pub looking fantastic. That's why we embrace the fact that we've got log fires, and we'll make it as homely as possible.
But it's interesting what you say about the attitudes towards what a pub is changing, and I wondered how that played into the late in the day, it seems, awareness that a pub is a building category that needs a little more attention.
Well, it's interesting what Martin's saying about food, because this pub, the Rose and Crown, is part of what I call the sort of reformed or improved pub movement, which happened between the wars, and that was doing very similar things to what you've described now. It was about making pubs much more friendly, family friendly, accessible, sort of safe, respectable environments.
They'd been previously a line of men coming off their work shift putting down the beer.
I think that they'd been essentially, they were trying to prevent a huge drunkenness of kind of the stereotype of the Victorian and the Edwardian sort of gin palace, just as a way of bringing families in, making this more respectable, sort of pleasant places to be.
Was it moving towards the idea of a gastropub at that point?
Well, they did start to serve food, and that was one of the differences, that rather than just coming and drinking as much as alcohol as you could consume in a short period of time, it was about bringing families in, having food. So the improved pubs introduced restaurants, sort of luncheon rooms, and also other activities like sports and games. So they're a way of bringing people in to use pubs for more than just consuming alcohol. And the architecture really reflected that, and that's part of what our research project has identified, is that they became bigger buildings, much more spacious. They had a very interesting sort of series of room partitions to allow for different groups of people to be doing different sorts of activities.
I was going to ask about that, because the Ivy House that we visited not so long ago on the podcast had a separate room that had clearly been designed as a mini mead hall, and it had been designed especially for people to eat in. So it sounds as though the revolution in more recent years has been to get the food out in and amongst the clientele who are drinking.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. There were very specific functions which happened in each space in the interwar pub, and obviously that's changed over time. They've been opened up. We can see that partitions here have largely been removed, so it is much more in favour of kind of open planning, and people do everything in every space. You can eat and drink in every space in most pubs now, whereas before it was very sort of regimented and architecturally defined as to where different groups, different classes of people would sit and do different activities. So it has opened up. The Ivy House, you're right to reference that. It's a really lovely pub of the same period, early 1930s, the same done for the same brewery, for Truman's, by the same architect, A.E. Sewell. And that large room, last time I was in there, I was playing in a big swing band in that very large luncheon room, which is now used for a diversity of activities. And that's very much sort of the trend, I think, in pubs today.
Let me check that I understood you correctly. This is a Truman's pub?
Yes, it was built for Truman, Hanbury, Buxton originally, and they were great leaders in sort of interwar reformed pub design. They built about 150 of the sort of new style pubs between the wars, many designed by Sewell, the architect who designed this, who was their sort of principal architect, and he was a great leader in the sort of respectable, dignified architecture of the interwar improved pub.
There's something I was dying to... I realised it never got out on the last podcast, so I'm going to just make amends for something that I should have more clearly described in the Ivy House podcast. In the conversation, you hear me talking to the chap there about a spittoon, and I realise I never described the spittoon, and apparently it's a signature Truman's Brewery spittoon, and you might think of a big bronze-coloured pot that people can hawk into, but actually it looked like a one-foot trough in front of the bar in black and white checkerboard tiles. It looked like a very elegant step, and of course as soon as you discover it's a spittoon you wouldn't want to step in that, but it was an amazing feature, and I wonder what other features here let you know that this is a Sewell pub.
Well, there's a particularly lovely feature which is a rare survival in this pub that's above our heads, and that's the vitrolite ceiling.
Oh right, yes. Now what is vitrolite?
Vitrolite is an opaque kind of milky glass manufactured by Pilkington's, and it's quite shiny. It looks sort of like it looks like glass really, or a little bit like a sort of shiny linoleum on the ceiling, and it's in a series of grids or panels. It's kind of a reference to the earlier sort of pressed tin metal ceilings that you see in commercial buildings. So it's here, it's a lovely, what colour would you describe it as? A sort of a milky yellow.
It should be brilliant white, actually.
Oh, right.
we might have to go to work.
That's closer to lime than white.
But actually, it's a funny story. In about 1989 or something, I think Arsenal just won the league, and there was lots of champagne stains on the ceiling. So my granddad, I think my mum and dad were away, my granddad and I got the ladders out and we started to clean the champagne marks off the ceiling and realised it wasn't this musky, orangey colour. It was indeed brilliant white. So we obviously wiped one and then we had to do the lot, which was pretty grim. Well, as you can see, is over on that, what would have been the old off licence once upon a time, they've had a go there and I think they've given up. So they've done half of it, they've done a tenth of it, so there's still work to do. So it will be done again. In fact, on the back of this, it will definitely be stuck.
It's kind of got to be now, hasn't it?
So it has to be. So it's actually, yes, the truth is, it should be brilliant white, not slightly off creamy colour.
Yeah.
In all seriousness, though, many years of smoking in pubs must have done some serious damage to their stroke, particularly with your interests, Emily, in preserving the building and preserving the character of the building, and smoking ain't good for any of those things.
No, I guess it sort of adds, over the years, it's kind of added a kind of patina or a sort of a quality that fits with what Martin was saying about this being a sort of homely, warm sort of pub. But yes, it probably, it's interesting, it would have been white, but it gives a lovely kind of modern, clean effect. And what's interesting about the pub is that it's very much in what we call a neo-Georgian style, which is sort of was considered very respectful, dignified kind of architecture. Looking back to previous centuries, but sort of slightly updated for the modern period. But the vitrolite ceiling really is very modern. I mean, it was quite sort of cutting-edge material to use in that period. And the shininess that you can see as you look across the pub really makes it feel very up-to-date and modern for the 1930s, and clean as well. And that also fits with this idea of improved pubs being respectable places, but also, you know, clean places where, you know, families could sit and feel comfortable.
I wonder how many pubs have actually had it in and taken it out over the last 75 years. It'd be quite interesting tonight, or 85 years.
Yeah.
Because it adds a lot of value to this pub, doesn't it? It looks fantastic, and you're right. If once cleaned and it's brilliant white, it's a fantastic attribute to the pub, for sure.
It's very rare. I mean, there aren't that many ceilings like this that survive, so it's lovely that you've got it. And we definitely mentioned that in the listing. Listing is a way of recognising what's special about a building, so we record in the list entry what features are the most important ones to preserve and to maintain in terms of character, and that's certainly something that's mentioned in the list entry for this building.
Could we talk through those choices or the principles behind those choices? I wonder whether something that seems valuable now, or whether there's any chance of the aesthetics of the day today being allowed to influence what is deemed to be important or not, historically speaking. How do you balance present tastes against keeping things that might in the future seem to be important to future generations?
Well, listing is a way of protecting and celebrating special architectural and historic interests. So when a building is listed, we do set out what's special about it, both historically but also in terms of the building's fabric. And we will mention in there what are original features, what are special features. And it's a guide, really, for owners and for managers of buildings to work out what should be kept. So it doesn't mean a building can't ever change, and it might be that there are certain features in here that in the future you might want to alter, and you would have a conversation with the local planning authority about what was appropriate to change, and economic factors can come into play, or social change can be a factor at that point. But when the building's listed, we really describe it sort of as it is now, and why that's significant. Listing is really a way of sort of recognising significance.
Could we think about perhaps another of the pubs in London that's been recently listed, and what are the features there that stood out for you on the strength of which the pub was listed?
Well, most of the London ones, certainly half of them, are also Sewell pubs, and so they're similarly in a kind of neo-Georgian style. We haven't actually looked at the outside of this one, but many of them will have the same sorts of features that we see here, sort of big grand sash windows, sort of swags, little sort of strings of floral decoration. This pub has a number of doors and windows, and that's quite significant. The other pubs that we've listed in London have those as well, and they're important because they help to indicate or signify what was happening inside and how the internal kind of plan form and arrangements, how the building was used socially, is reflected in the architecture. And so that's quite an important aspect of all the pubs that we've listed in London. And one of the things that we look at in terms of listing is not only special architectural quality, but also how well a building survives. So that's a really important factor, particularly for public houses. We look at, you know, what survives in terms of panelling, fireplaces, the bar counter, other sort of fixtures and fittings. And this pub is lovely because so much of those internal fittings survive. There's a lot of built-in inlaid work saying Truman's, and that's lovely because it gives a really strong kind of reference to the historic origins of the building.
So one of the things I know that organisations that preserve buildings, historic buildings, for the future sometimes find themselves looking at is rather than the exceptional, the extremely ordinary. They might be looking at a typical council flat of a particular period and saying, OK, we need to preserve that so that we know what that looked like. Is there any danger by celebrating the interesting architecture of, and design of Sewell that just really humdrum examples might get overlooked?
It's certainly something that we consider, because we obviously want to represent the broad spectrum of history on the National Heritage List. So listing isn't just about celebrating the most grand, important architectural examples. I mean, while this is a beautifully designed pub and was you know, quite well designed and well made, high quality materials for the time, it's not, you know, it's not the sort of grandest of commercial architecture. So it is, in a sense, representing ordinary life from the 1930s, but just in a particularly well preserved and beautifully made example. What's really interesting about this pub, we could talk a little bit about the partitions and the fact that the different spaces were originally designed to do different things, and that's very well reflected in the architectural fabric which survives. And it's a nice way of being able to read the past, being able to read ordinary life of the past through the building today. And we're sitting in the public bar. Exactly.
Actually, it fascinates me actually that it was separated. Like you said earlier, it was almost different class of people going to their own bar. They knew where they should belong almost. So this will be the public bar where we're sitting now. And what was fascinating was because it was the workers and the lads would come into the public bar, but the beer was cheaper. So it was in the same space, but the beer was 10 or 20% cheaper. They would charge 10 or 20% cheaper.
For the same beer?
For the same beer, depending on where he was sitting in the pub. But it would have his own entrance. So as you can see, this pub's got four different doors, and you'd have five bars in here. So you'd have a public bar, you'd have a snug. Apparently, the snug would be where sort of the landlord and his mates kind of hung out in that kind of area of the bar. I was probably a bit cliquey and probably a bit of a bore fest that I'd probably best avoided, but that's where you'd go if you knew the landlord and he was a regular hardcore. And then you'd have the saloon or the private bar, which would be one up from the public, and then you'd have the lounge, where I think it was probably quite grand in its day, wasn't it? So you'd come into the lounge. So if he was going out for dinner maybe back in the day, you'd go into the lounge bar. You might leave the, you might come back round, and I would come back round and all with my beer in the public and go back into the lounge. but of course, this bar here would serve five bars, as it were.
And the off-licence
And the off-licence, yeah, absolutely.
So this place is, as the listener will have guessed from the description, is very open now. Clearly the class distinctions, we would want them to be erased. We don't want to believe that they're still going on. But is there any mileage, I wonder, in your mind, have you toyed with the idea of separating up bits of the pub to get them to do different things on the same night?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think you probably could. With a space, it's a good sized pub, it's a big pub. So you probably could actually. And there are different walks of life. You know, I'm a working class lad, but I live in Stoke Newington. There's lots of sort of middle class, well to do guys here. And so there is a mixed bag within. It is a melting pot of London, after all. And we are the hub of the community. So whilst I prefer it being open planned, you probably could turn this back into a public bar, and certainly if the beer was cheaper, you'd probably get a few other lads in and boys and girls in who would prefer it. Yeah, I think there's probably mileage. Whether you'd want to go back there, no. I prefer the fact that the great thing about pubs is that it is a great melting pot, and your local scallywag could talk to the Lord of the Realm and they could sit next to each other at the bar and get on famously. And that's what I love about pubs, and that's what's great about Stoke Newington, and a lot of what's great about London personally, the fact that we all do mix together. And the pubs, you know, that's what makes our pubs national treasures for me, is that we all can come together in a boozer for whatever your history is and enjoy a pint of beer together. So for me, whilst I think you probably could do that, I prefer the fact that it's open plan, and it's probably become open plan for a reason. You know, the idea of having five different bars with five different, depends on what your mood is and what sort of, you know, where you go to work, is a bit Dragonia, really. So the fact that it is open plan, I think speaks volumes about the way London is today. So I think it's a good thing.
Well, we're going to stick a break in just there. We're going to get
on that bombshell.
We're going to find out what our sponsor has to say, and please do support the sponsor, please, because they're keeping us doing what we're doing. We're going to be back after that, and we'll be talking a little bit more about Stoke Newington, I think, and also about the organisation that is looking after buildings from the past and making sure that they continue to be buildings from the present.
We have teamed up with audible.co.uk to offer you a free audiobook of your choice. All you have to do is register for 1 month free trial to claim your free audiobook. There are over 150,000 to choose from. The 30-day free trial means you can choose a free audiobook, which is yours to keep whether or not you decide to cancel in the trial period. And there's more good news. If you trialed the service over 12 months ago, the good people at Audible are giving you a chance to get your hands on another audiobook for free. So sign up at www.audible.co.uk/Londonist.
Londonist Out Loud is free every week. You can support the show.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
And Londonist via the Londonist shop, where you'll find excellent gift ideas, including London postcard t-shirts, the Secrets of the Tube DVD, chunky logo mugs, tote bags, hoodies, the Inspector Sands tea, and the Londonist Oyster card holder. Treat yourself, support us, and share your love of London at londonist.com/shop.
You're listening to Londonist Out Loud. I'm Anne Quentin Wolfe, with me Martin Harley, the landlord of the Rose and Crown here in Stoke Newington, and Emily G of Historic England. And the phrase I'm not allowed to use on the podcast is... We can't even say it. It's like the name of he who cannot be named.
No, not allowed at all. But we were talking about the fact that the organisation English Heritage...
Do you know what? A load of interference just kicked in on the mic at that point. It might be that we're...
You've got a phone bill.
Oh, yes. Sorry.
Yeah, it's a corporate... It's a corporate phone.
Is it Historic England that was calling you just then?
No, I think it might have been the minicab, actually.
Oh, okay.
I imagine.
They really are policing this.
I think you should delve deeper in that one.
Yeah, there's something suspicious.
It's really not an issue. I mean, it's... but I can
I'm intrigued myself.
Yeah.
So what is the deal there with the change of name? What's happened?
All right. So I work for Historic England, which is an arm's length body. We work for the Department for Culture, Media and Sport. And we do a number of different functions, one of which is listing, but also research and policy and planning issues. And we used to be part of English Heritage, had been for over 20 years. But in April, the organisation split into two. So English Heritage still exists as an organisation, but that's now a charity. And that looks after the historic properties that are in our care and guardianship. So in London, for example, Kenwood House is cared for by English Heritage. And we are now called Historic England. So there's the functions have split, but we continue to be obviously friends and brothers and sisters alongside each other, but doing different sorts of work, but all towards supporting the historic environment as a whole.
And what have you got your eye on in London? I know maybe this might be a sensitive question. I know anything to do with planning and people buying and selling property in the capital always comes with non-disclosures and things like that. So as far as you're able to say, what sort of thing have you got your eye on preserving in the capital at the moment?
Right. Well, in listing, we do two different strands of work. One is that we're still very responsive. So if a building or a site is under threat, and if it's significant, then we will turn to look at it as soon as we can and to say whether or not it should be protected. So we will always continue to have that kind of responsive function. It's something that, as an organisation, we've always been set up to do, to protect things that need protecting. But we also do much more strategic work these days. So we look at thematic projects like, for example, the Interwar Public House, and a number of other projects to help sort of provide a national context from which we can protect the best examples before they're threatened and help to sort of provide clarity and certainty for owners. So at the moment, we do work across all different types of buildings, landscapes, archaeology. But at the moment, we're looking at a number of... a project on post-war public sculpture, which again is something which is much loved. It's public sculpture is something that enlivens the public and civic realm for all of us, and we all sort of love the importance of art in the public realm, but it is under threat. It can be removed, it can be vandalised, it can be sold. So we're looking at post-war sculpture in particular across the country, but much of that, of course, is in London, and it's something that we hope to mark with an exhibition, a public exhibition, early in 2016, and we will announce a batch of listings at that time as well, like we did with the Interwar Pubs.
How does it work? Is there a set of qualifying features about a place that would automatically gain it some sort of protection? You know, maybe its age or it having been designed by a particular person or some other feature?
Well, as I mentioned before, listing is broadly about special architectural and historic interest. So those are the words that appear in the Planning Act. But obviously that has different manifestations depending on what the building or site or structure is. So the types of things we take into account are, as you say, age. You know, the older something is, the more likely it is to be listed. We're much stricter about buildings that date from after 1945, for example. But age is a big factor. Also, architectural quality is an important consideration. The caliber and importance of the designer, of the architect, how well it survives. We look at how buildings have changed over time, and the better surviving a building is, like the Rose and Crown, for example, then it's more likely to be listed if it also has architectural quality or historic interest. And it's worth pointing out that we do also recommend, and buildings are listed for their special historic interest, even if it's less well surviving or less important architecturally. And you might be aware of the Royal Vauxhall Tavern, the pub that was listed recently in Vauxhall, which is a smart mid-19th century pub. Wouldn't quite have been listable for that alone, although it does have architectural quality. But the reason that we recommended it is for that, in tandem with its importance as one of the earliest and most important LGBTQ pubs in the capital. So that's a way of reflecting special historic interest on the National Heritage List as well, which is an important aspect of things as well.
What I don't think I've heard in your answer is, Senator, those qualities mean that it moves up the table for discussion, but it didn't sound as though there's an automatic listing function. For example, if something's older than 500 years old, then it automatically gets listed. There's nothing like that.
It's not automatic, no. I mean, it's more likely that the older something is, the more likely it will be listable. But we don't just go around sort of automatically looking at things. It depends on either sites that are brought to our attention. So if something's under threat, then that will trigger an assessment. An assessment, of course, is the process of going through, checking how something sits against the criteria. We publish a number of what we call selection guides online, which are really accessible documents on every type of building, which sets out the kinds of things we look for. So there is one, for example, on commercial buildings, which talks about what we look for in a pub when we're seeing if it should be listed.
So how much was this triggered by the fact that the two property developers just turned up one afternoon and knocked that pub down in northwest London? I mean, was that a trigger for, actually, we have to preserve our pubs here? I mean, I know, for me, whilst, I'm delighted with the listing, it adds security for the Rose and Crown. Like I said, my family's been here 30 years, and I hope, whilst I may not be here for 30 years, I hope the pub's still here in 30 years' time, which is very important. But I just wonder if that was that a focal point? I mean, did that sort of awaken people to say, actually, we need to do something about here? You can't just come and knock your local boozer down because you want to build a six flats there or a supermarket.
Yes, I mean, the pub, which the Carlton Tavern you're talking about in Maida Vale, which was demolished, it was a building that we were looking at as part of the project.
Is that right?
So, as I mentioned before, one of the triggers for the research project as a whole was the threat and vulnerability to the building type. And that's a sort of prime example of really, while the project was underway, that the pub was demolished. We were assessing it for listing. And yes, it's an illustration.
It was already underway to look at listing the pubs. Okay.
Yeah.
This must be a competitive category then. Pubs seem to be being redeveloped into bedsits or flats. They seem to be going under fast.
Well, in terms of what would be listable, it has to be special nationally. So it's very selective. So not automatically every pub from the interwar would be protected. As I say, about 3,000 were built, and there may be fewer than 100 on the national list. So it's selective in that sense. We have to compare one to another, and they have to be really good architecturally and surviving well and historically important to be listed.
Of those 3,000 that were built, how many survive? Nothing worse than being put on the spot.
I don't have a figure, but it's a relatively small number. I think that's what the importance of the research was, is it identified how prolific it was as a new building type between the wars, but that very few survive. And of those that survive, very few are special enough to be listed. And obviously buildings are important that aren't listed as well, but it's a way of maintaining special character. Other buildings will be locally listed, pubs in particular, and there's a assets of community value is a new designation which has come in, which is a way of communities identifying what's important to them locally. Even if it's not special enough to be listed, it's a way of thinking particularly about change of use, which is something you mentioned, preserving pubs as pubs rather than as of other new building types.
And this acts as a nudge, as a bit of a lever, but is there a legal status attached to it?
Yeah, it's a designation within the planning system, so it's a local designation. It's something that's handled locally.
I think the community are given 6 months to find a buyer or to buy it themselves. So there's that window where you can say, actually, we'll give it asset of community value, like you say, and it's council-driven, or government-driven, and they will give the community, as it were, 6 months to find a buyer. So if everyone's screaming, shouting from the rooftops about they want to keep their pub open, well, go on then, keep it open. So you get 6 months to either find a buyer, run it yourself. Not that I would recommend sort of the whole community running it, I don't think that would work personally, but to find an operator or sort of a landlord or a publican to go in and operate it. So it is given, this asset of community value. I think it's really important for pubs, because often you will find pubs are just being turned in a heartbeat, because a pub like this, for example, was a great building. I would love to own the building. We don't own the lease, but it's a great building and a great site in London. It's a big pub. Now, as a property play, the guys would tell you, you could build 15 flats, or it would be a great Tesco's Metro or whatever it may be. So the fact that it's going to stay, and this listed thing for me gives it security, and I think that's what's really, really important about this as well. Whether our landlords are as happy as I am about it, I don't know, because maybe I'm not sure if it deflects value or not, but certainly as a pub, this will now remain, I believe this remains as a pub, right, because it's now listed. So you can't become a supermarket chain overnight.
We're scathing over that, though. Is that actually the case? Does it have to remain used for the same purpose?
It doesn't have to. Obviously, we say that the best purpose for a listed building is the original purpose, the original function.
Sure.
It doesn't mean that a building can't change, but obviously what's significant about this building, in part, is the architecture on the outside, but also the architecture on the inside. So we've been very clear about internal partitions, fixtures, fittings that are special, the bar counter, for example. So were in the future this or another listed pub to be under consideration for a change of use, then that would be a really important question for the owner to weigh up with the local authority about what change could happen. And it might be that that's considered, the decision that it would be completely inappropriate to remove all of the internal fixtures and fittings, which, because they are special architecturally. So it's not something that listing provides a mandate for, but it's certainly an important factor.
You wouldn't get many brides in the Tesco, would you? Or a supermarket chain. Here she is, looking lovely in the Rosencrantz boozer.
Well, we've been recording as though by way of illustrating the community uses available to a pub. And this is 11 o'clock in the morning. A bride in her full bridal regalia has come in, and she's being photographed at the bar counter. Is this a regular occurrence?
Actually, it is, funny enough. We're fortunate enough to be opposite the town hall, Stoke Newington Town Hall, and next to a church. And of course, we have a beautiful six-bedroom boutique guest house upstairs. So it's an ideal place to come and put the family up and get married across the road and come down and have a few sherbets along the way. That's our ideal. Actually, they're looking very lovely, and the flowers are very nice too, aren't they? We do lots of weddings. We're a big fan of weddings, and they're probably all staying upstairs as well, which is great.
So I'm worried that we've uncovered a potential pitfall in this listing scheme, which it sounds like if somebody who bought this place to live in is prepared to do so with the bar counter intact and the place still looking like a pub. I mean, it would be a weird person who did that, but it sounds as though the pub trade within it is not preserved.
Well, actually, that's interesting, just listening to Emily there, when she said, actually, it doesn't need still to be a pub. So my thinking about it was believing that it was, as if it's listed, then it should remain a pub. So that's interesting, and I'm sure there's plenty of ways around it. Hopefully, it's all about the local community, and because I was mentioned earlier about the asset of community value, it does indeed, I believe, has to stay as it is. So hopefully, there's enough people that, you know, love this pub and their own local boozers up and down the country that will fight for them. I think our local boozers are so important to the community. I really do. I mean, a lot of people come out late at night, might be by themselves. You know, they can't go anywhere else, but they come to their local pub. And I think it's, it adds so much weight to the community. So I think we should fight for them. I'm a big fan. We're not going anywhere. We've been here, like I say, the family's been here for 30 years. Hopefully we'll be here for another 30 years. As far as change of use goes, I'm sure there's some unscrupulous characters that would like to change it into. I'm not sure. What do you think this could be, apart from a boozer? What else could it be? With the bar counter intact.
Okay. Well, okay. I think it should be a model railway shop.
That's interesting.
I think I would, because it's a nice big curved bar. I would run my N-gauge railway around there, I think.
All by yourself?
Yeah, just me. I'd be wearing my little peaked train driver's hat.
But you'd be dying to take the beer pumps out. You leave a couple of beer pumps in, surely, so you could still pour yourself a beer while you do it.
Well, maybe I'll turn those into speed controllers.
But the old hand pumps, maybe, but not the other ones. You get rid of the old ones, keep the hand pumps. Get rid of the old ones.
Or maybe we just leave it as a pub for. What's going on? As a landlord, do you get the chance to talk to other landlords much, or are you kind of shut off from each other by your work?
No, not really. I think we're quite certainly in the. We've got a craft beer pub down the road, the Jolly Butchers, and in the craft beer game, it's we're all in all for one and one for all, pretty much. Especially the young brewers that are coming in now, the artisan young brewers. It's a big scene, and everyone looks out for each other. I mean, the craft beer scene's gone crazy in the last 5 or 6 years, and many brewers, many pubs. So it is tricky for everybody. Don't get me wrong; it's a competitive market. But I think it's such that everyone's in it together, and everyone's looking to brew great beer, better beer all the time. So it is whilst there is a competitive edge to other publicans and owners that I know, I certainly get on with everyone I've ever come across in the business. And it is, because it's a tough game, see, because it is a tough business, it's a hard game, there's lots of legislation involved. I think it's better to be able to lean on. There's lots of bodies you can go to, there's lots of conferences that we all tend to go to meet up and discuss pitfalls and problems and lots of whinging. You'd always hear publicans whinging because there's lots to whinge about, too. But there is, if you get it right, I mean, it can be a good business.
Since the country shook its piggy bank a few years ago and discovered there wasn't very much in there, the luxury end of things seems to have, it seems perverse, but it's prospered right across the board. And the bottom end, so you know, the really cheap, Parliament High selling cheap businesses have done well, and it's been the middle market that seems to have suffered the most. Has that been reflected in the pub trade?
Well, I'm not sure. I think we are, because I'd say we're in the middle there somewhere. I mean, our food is generally around about the tenner mark, which I think is reasonable. We don't charge £16 for a main, which you can do, but I think you've got to be fantastic. If I'm paying £16 for a main meal anywhere, it's got to be fantastic, especially if I'm in a pub. So, you know, so we charge around about a tenner mark. I don't think so. I think if you're good and you offer different things, it's all about the offer, pretty much. I mean, if you're not offering anything new, anything different, then you've got to be bloody good at. We're lucky here because we offer good beer, good wine, a good ambience, and that's what's the key. However, if you're opening a pub tomorrow, maybe a wee bit out of town, or you've got to be good at what you do. You've got to offer great food, you've got to offer great beer, great service. It's more than just opening a pub. If anyone thinks about the idea of just opening a boozer, I'm going to go and open a pub tomorrow, forget it. You know your business, know what you're going to sell, know who you're targeting, who's your target audience, what do you want to sell, what you're going to sell, who you're going to sell it to. So it's not just a case of opening up and selling the same old big brews anymore. You know, the big pub companies and the big brewers. Yeah, Londoners are more discerning. We've got social media now. People are more discerning than they've ever been. People's taste buds, you know, they want to try new things, they want to try different things. So that's why, for example, we have a pub down the road with 25,000 beers on the bar. We change them daily, we change them weekly, and people are coming in trying new brews, new stuff every day of the week. You can't just, you know, people are not coming in for the old school sort of light and bitters anymore. You know, they want more than that. And I think that's a good thing, because it keeps everyone on their toes.
You said something there that sent a chill through me, and I want to react to what my body was telling me there. And it was about if you were opening up a pub.
Yeah.
And just the thought of that. I mean, I know, for instance, that opening a restaurant is notoriously full of jeopardy. You're unlikely to survive, is the fact of the matter. Opening up a pub with all the overheads and staff costs there, that seems even less likely, unless you're coming in to run a pub that already exists, or... Yeah. You're part of some bigger organisation that can back you up during the first few years. Who starts their own pub from scratch? Does anyone do that?
They do.
Really?
However, I would suggest don't. Don't do it. It's hard. I mean, like I say, my parents got in the game 30 years ago. I mean, they long retired to Spain 15 years ago, but they got in the game. I struggled through. Me and my wife struggled through in the early days, and it's a long process. I mean, we've got 6 pubs now, but we ran one for 12 years, morning, noon and night, took very, very few holidays. And it's only now we've kind of, you know, 18 years on where we're doing okay, and we have managers, and life's better than it's ever been. But it's a long process to get where we are now. You've got to kind of do the hard yards, and you've got to put in a shift or two. So I wouldn't really recommend it. I think the problem is with this game is lots of legislation. You've got EHO, you've got police, you've got fire brigades, you've got councils, you've got, you know, every government body is kind of breathing down your neck. So there's lots to think about. And just when you've covered all those bases, you've then got sort of a pub to open and a pub to close 7 days a week.
Oh yes, there's that as well.
Just on top of it. So yeah, and then not to mention people might have too much to drink, and then you've got to get rid of them late at night, and it's never ending. So I don't want to sound like the voice of doom on this, but it's a tricky business, and I wouldn't jump in feet first, readily, easily.
Would you do it again, or would you make a different choice?
I didn't have too many choices, so it was kind of useful. I've had a great time, and I'm a people person, so I've enjoyed looking after people. I've enjoyed hosting. And I think if you're a good mind host and you enjoy hosting, looking after people, because that's the key to it. If you're not a people person, if you don't enjoy actually making sure people are having a nice time, then it could be a bit tricky. Then you're probably going to struggle a wee bit. But I enjoy looking after people. I enjoy seeing people have a good time. They leave their pubs going, I've had a really great time. It's a really nice pub, blah, blah, blah. And I think a pub, you get a feel for a pub when you walk in, who runs it, what their personality. I think it's very important that you put your own personality across in a pub. You know, whilst we have different pubs with different personalities, they all have, you know, an ethos behind them, which is good beer, good atmosphere, and it's all about the ambience and the company and the people that are drinking in there, rather than imposing some loud music or some big screens. And we kind of shy away from that, really. We're trying to keep it quite simple.
Now, I wonder, with that in mind, with a bunch of different pubs up your sleeve, with different personalities, does that mean that each of the pubs reflects a different bit of your personality, or is there one that you feel much more at home in?
Really good question, actually. Well, I've been in the restaurants for 18 years, so that's kind of probably more my personality. Having said that, I'm a bit of a beer geek on the QT, so the Jolly Butchers is my baby as well, because of my love for sort of craft beer, or good beer. It doesn't have to be craft beer necessarily, just of good beer. So yeah, you're probably right. And of course, this pub I love because it's in the family. It's been in the family 30 years. So yeah, there is a lot of that, actually. It is about your personality. And I think if you were to get into the business, I think it's got to be about what you love, and you've got to be about what you like. Trying to pretend running a pub that actually not got your feel, your take on it, is probably the wrong way to do it. So it's a bit like having a restaurant, you know, and trying to sort of run a Chinese restaurant when you're from India, maybe. It probably wouldn't work. So I guess...
Well, there's a place in Walthamstow which would take issue with that, actually.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay. Well, that was a bad example then, in that case. I suppose the point I'm trying to make is, you've got to be comfortable with what you do. If you're a sports nut, you might want to run a sports bar, and I understand that, and that's great. I love sport, but I don't really want to put it in the pubs, because I don't think it's what we're about. So, yeah, no, I think it is, the personality-wise, you're probably right, you've probably nailed me on that one.
Well, having nailed the landlord, I'm now going to... No, you can't finish a podcast like that. That sounds awful. Let's try that again. All right.
Taxi for one.
Yeah. Quickly, please. Well, on that note, just and only because the clock tells us we're coming to the end of the show, we've got to take our leave. Jolly Butchers is where?
It's on Stone Newton High Street.
So you're keeping it very local.
Yeah, we're local, yeah. We've also got the Crown and Anchor in Brixton, which is also a sister pub to the Jolly Butchers, which is also a fabulous craft beer pub as well. Yeah.
And then there's the Rose and Crown here where we've recorded. And if you want to attempt a sighting of Martin Harley, then you know where to go. For today, though, we've got to call it a day. Emily G and Martin Harley, thanks very much.
Great, thank you very much for having me in this lovely building.
Thanks, Wayne. All the best. My heart aches for some
far off days. That's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Emily G and Martin Harley. Thanks too to Mark Barr and Bernie Barkley. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.